following program is a presentation of the FlyPod New Media Network, www.theflypod.com.
FlyPod.com. I'm Mark DeWitt. Welcome to Cover to Cover. Today we have the author of his very first book, City of Women, David R. Gillam. David, welcome.
Thank you so much, Mark. I appreciate it.
David, you take us back to World War II during the Hitler bombings. They've been in Moscow, and we're in a city that's basically women.
That's right, Berlin at the height of the Second World War, and my main character is Sigrid Schroeder, who's a war wife, and her husband, like several hundreds of thousands of other husbands and brothers and fathers, are at the Eastern Front, and Berlin has become a city of women, and she's living this dull drudgery of an existence on a daily basis, going to work, coming back home, arguing with her mother-in-law, and then repeating everything the next day. And that's the Berlin, a gritty place of shortages and substitute ingredients that we find there.
And, you know, they're so short with stuff. They have potatoes, which are almost rotten in a sense, but you peel them. It's against the law even to throw the peelings
in. That's right, and that's true. It's one of the things I tried to do in this book is infuse it with this very rich historical detail that I have mined over all the books and movies and photographs and everything that I've seen and the actual research I did while I was in Berlin. And that the particular thing was absolutely true. By law, you could not throw away your vegetable scraps. You had to save them so that the state could turn them into pig slop later on. And that's what I tried to do, in fact, when I was developing the drama of it, is include those details so that you never got a boring history lesson. You just got the action that had those details included.
Yeah, little nuggets of things that were actually going on that people never do think of, like the cities. You know, I would have never thought City of Women. Well, yeah, everybody's gone.
Right. That's right.
So the kind of research that you did on this, sounds like you went to Berlin, you went around Germany?
I did. I went to Berlin. The first time I went, it was just after the wall came down. In fact, they were literally still removing sections of the wall. And I remember right around that area, I came across this building that had these facades sheared off completely, and two or three stories, and it was an apartment building. You could see up into the old apartments. You could still see the wallpaper that the inhabitants had once put up. And that struck me so that I, in fact, used that in the book. One evening after the RAF, the Royal Air Force, is done on a bombing raid, Sigrid walks out to work, turns the corner, and finds this building with the facade sheared off. Again, that was the sort of thing I tried to do, use the historical detail to push the action forward and enrich the characters.
Sigrid, it doesn't sound like she really, or maybe the mother-in-law really doesn't like her.
No, she has a quite stormy relationship with her husband's mother, Mother Schroeder, that continues throughout the book. They are at odds. Mother Schroeder, her mother-in-law, wants to be the matriarch of the apartment, but still depends on Sigrid. As the book unfolds, we find, because she's living a lonely life. Her husband is dead. Her son's at war. She really has no one else other than her daughter-in-law and her friends, that she's her Kaffeeklatsch, that I call it, that she's been friends with for 20 years. But, you know, she really needs Sigrid there. But Sigrid, of course, this is just all part of the drudgery for her, until one night at a cinema, she goes to find just a little bit of privacy somewhere, just a little solitude, when suddenly a woman who she barely knows seizes her by the arm and says, "Please say I came in here with you." And the decision she makes at that point turns Sigrid's life upside down forever.
City of Women, plenty of intertwining of different stories, especially a love interest here also.
Yes. While she was in that theater, she was thinking back. She had had a lover at one point who was Jewish, and his name was Aegon. And really, Aegon is the love of her life. And she was just remembering him, and he reappears as the book continues. And her, by this point, she is heavily involved in trying to save people from the Gestapos, whether they're Jewish or political, it doesn't really matter. And when her old lover reappears, and that, of course, derails what she's doing and sends her life out on another, yet another tangent that no one expected, that certainly she never expected.
When you were writing book City of Women, did you look at that and you did you say, gosh, what would happen if an Aryan woman during the Hitler regime actually found a Jewish love?
Well, the law, and I put this in there, spells it out pretty clearly what would happen. They'd both be executed or sent to a concentration camp. Certainly, the man would be executed if he was Jewish, and the woman would be sent to a KZ, which is the abbreviation for concentration Lager in German. So she knows that she's taking a terrible chance. But by this point, she's already taking so many chances, and she's a very passionate, very daring woman whose life has just gotten bottled up in a way that she never really intended it to be. So once she starts getting involved with this effort to save people, and then Aegon returns, her life sort of explodes again in this flood of passion and drama and excitement.
Seems like the mother-in-law, well, she loves peach brandy, I think.
But, yes.
You know, I don't really know that she likes Hitler and likes what they're doing.
The mother-in-law, a very complicated character. I mean, I tried to make all my characters give them a sort of a gray moral ambiguity about them rather than being black or white. Her mother-in-law is a party member and has been for a long time. There were a lot of women who went to Hitler in the early 30s when he first came into power and went to and joined the Nazi party. And of course, at this point, she continues to pay her dues because, you know, it's difficult to stop. You'd have to explain why are you stopping becoming a party member. And of course, she still thinks that's going to give her some benefit at some time. She's constantly saying, you know, somebody has to keep our name strong with the party, and when they're doing these various collections for clothing or whatever it happens to be. But yes, she compartmentalizes it as I think many people of the time did into what she wanted to see and what the reality of it was. And what she wanted to see is what she concentrated on, and the hideous reality of what the Nazis were actually up to, she ignored completely, even though that was paraded quite literally in front of her eyes at the time, too.
So when you were in Berlin, now, you know, I should ask also, did you get a little piece of the rock from the wall? That's what I was wondering when you
yeah,
were talking about
I did.
That.
In fact, you know, I make jokes about bringing Berlin home one piece at a time. I did get a piece of the wall, actually, although another friend had also sent me a piece that they had bought, and who knows where it actually came from. It could have come from New Jersey, for all I know. But it was a little piece of concrete, and you could see where the rebar was in it. But I also picked a piece of Anhalter-Bahnhof, which at the height of the war was still the largest rail station in Central Europe. And at the book's climax, when she's being pursued by the SS, she goes through Anhalter-Bahnhof. Now it is nothing but a piece of rubble. A part of the facade is left of the front entrance. So I picked a little piece of that rock as well and brought it home with me.
When you were in Berlin, did you interview people that were there at that time?
Not while I was in Berlin, actually. My German is passable sometimes, but not terrific. I did have the opportunity to talk to a few people who had been in Germany at that time, or perhaps whose parents had been in Germany. What I did with Berlin is I brought my Baedeker's 1920 guide to Berlin, and I tried to find what was still left and what the streets, you know, where the streets that had been there, if they were still there, and what they looked like, and how you would travel from one spot to another.
Did you have GPS at the time?
No, no, I did not. That was before that. This was in the early 90s. So I just did it by maps and by walking. I walked the city from one end to the other, practically.
So how did the map change from the actual city that you were in?
A good deal of the map didn't exist any longer. Depending on what part of the city you were in, the West was a little bit better shape than what we call the Mitte, which is the center of the city, which had basically been leveled. So those areas, you tried to find a few landmarks that might still exist, a bridge or a building or something like that, but most of that was gone. Some of the subway tunnels were still around and some of the subway buildings, and so that's the sort of thing in fact, the patent office she works at is still there on the same street, and that's how I got the idea to put her there, because I came across it.
As an author, did you take any liberties with changing Berlin up a little bit, or everything?
I tried to be as exact as possible with my historical details, whether it was how they were getting from one spot to another, what train they were on, what bus they were on. The mother-in-law smokes all the time, and her cigarettes are made from ground acorns, and they smell horrible, and they make cigarettes sick all the time. So those are the sort of details that I look for, too.
So they actually smoked ground acorns
at
the time?
That is correct.
Did you grind some up to smell them?
No, I didn't, actually. I took their word for it, that it smelled pretty acrid.
Let's find out about why a book during World War II.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I tried to make the book very exciting and hope I succeeded, and the characters very rich and the history very realistic and detailed. But I was really interested in writing a book about how we make moral choices. And in fact, Sigrid, the main character, when she's in that movie theater that I mentioned, and the young woman grabs her arm and says, "Please say I came in here with you, the lights go up and in come the Gestapo, and it's obvious they're after this woman, and she has the choice. Does she mind her own business, or does she save her? And she decides to save her, but it's not because she's making a statement against the oppressive fascist government. She thinks the Gestapo man's a bully, and she doesn't like bullies, so she does so. And that's what I wanted to look at, how we make moral choices based on what and how we deal with the consequences, both intended and unintended.
So actually, when you're doing this, then, you know, like you mentioned here, what's the outcome, I guess? That's what mm-hmm. you look at when you do that.
Right. What's the outcome? And as a dramatist, I have the ability to, of course, control that outcome to some extent, although I do like to think that my characters also, if once they hit a certain critical mass, also have the ability to control their own destinies. So what I try to do is explore that gray area that I spoke of earlier, where people make decisions. Maybe they do good, but maybe they do it for the wrong reasons, or just the reverse. They might do evil for the right reasons, and what's the effect that has on people and how they continue to try to redeem themselves. That's really what the book is about, I think. It's about hope. If you wanted me to sum it up in a single word, I would say hope, lighting that candle against the darkness.
All right, City of Women, how long did this book take to write? Because it sounds like you did quite a bit of research.
I did, although this is not the first book I've written. It's the first one that's published. And I had been doing research on Berlin for probably 20 years and have written a great deal about it. This particular novel took probably around a year or a little less to actually write the first time for the first draft. And then I worked on it again for my agent, Rebecca Gradinger, and then Amy Einhorn again for my great editor, Amy Einhorn at Amy Einhorn Books, also helped. And in fact, you know, both those women really helped me mold the book in a way that made it a better book, a better novel.
I think the fun stories I find out about is how many times were you maybe turned down by a publisher, maybe you sent it in to the first person and they accepted it.
This book was accepted by the first person.
Really? That doesn't
well, I
happen
mean, my,
a lot.
My agent accepted it, and then, I was very lucky with this book. Amy liked it, and the rest is history, as they say. Certainly other people have had different stories. And the book before this went through, I don't know, a dozen, maybe twice that many, two dozen editors who gave me a lot of glowing rejections, but it never actually got published. So, but I just continued. So that's the message to anybody out there who's writing that novel and it's been turned down. Just don't stop. Just don't stop. Keep at it.
So did you save the letters?
Yes, I did. Yeah.
One of these days you'll go back and go, oh, look at that. City of Women. Now, are you continuing on with this book as a series, a standalone?
No, I think it is a standalone. I am actually at work on my next book, which I'm afraid I'm a little hesitant to talk about just because it's in a very fragile state at the moment. It's in that I'm still seeing exactly which direction it's going to go. But I can tell you that it is historical and that it takes place in Amsterdam, in post-war Amsterdam and New York in the 1950s.
When you're writing something like City of Women, goes through several revisions, what's the process of that?
Well, every writer is different, I know. The way I tend to write is I will revise the work from the day before and sort of comb through it as a way to get warmed up and then hit the new material. I don't work with an outline. I find them too constricting. If I do write an outline, I tend to abandon it anyway early on because the characters start to grow and they start shaping the direction of the plot as well. So I tend to have an idea about what's going to happen at the end or at the climax and head toward that idea in the same way you might, you know, follow the sun or something like that. But I don't exactly have it mapped out.
So as the characters change as you're writing, and I guess the thing is just keep writing.
Yes.
And you're going to get to that end, I guess.
That's right. I mean, and that's what happens. And I try to always keep in mind, I was strange as a screenwriter at USC. And so I tend to still think cinematically. I like to think that a lot of the scenes in them are very cinematic. They're very visual. I tend to advance action by the way people pick up their cups or that sort of thing because I like to infuse even the smallest gesture with characters' meaning at some points. So I tend to do that. I also think about reversals. You know, if you watch a TV show or a movie, you'll see that in a scene halfway through, something will happen that will turn the scene around 180 degrees, or actually become even more so, and that's the reversal. And so I think in terms of that when I'm writing my scenes, even though it's fiction in a novel.
As a screenwriter, you're not putting in any not too much action or anything like that. Is that up to the director, I would guess?
When you're writing a screenplay, yes, you do put in what happens. And again, people have different styles, but you don't go to long details of the number of shots you're going to have or the, you know, how the car is going to turn left or where it's going to explode or whatever, that sort of stuff. Yeah, you leave that up to the director until a shooting script is done. But when you're just writing a screenplay to market, you don't have that material in there. You sort of get across the essence of the scene without the details. In the book, however, I'm at the shooting script level already, if you would, and so I have to include those details, and I like to do it rather than tell you, the reader, how to feel or how to react to a character. I want to show you the character and how they're moving or how they're looking or what their expression is like or how their eyes are responding to something that's said to them, and just like you were watching it on the screen, and therefore make your own decisions.
Sounds like after, you know, writing screenplays for you, you've got a little more sense of action and what's going on in the book than maybe some authors do.
Well, I don't want to say that I have more sense. I certainly have a cinematic sense, though, I think. Many people have told me when they're reading the book, they say, oh, that's what's like I was watching a movie. So that's my particular advantage from being trained in screenwriting. And I started out as a dramatist, too. So I hear dialogue in my head. And I like to use dialogue, too, in order to advance what's going on.
So how did you get involved with writing novels? When did you decide to go from screenplays to novels?
A man named Shelley Leonkoff, who was a professor at University of Southern California when I was getting my master's in writing, taught a fiction writing class, and I took his class, and he turned me into a fiction writer. One of the things about the movie industry, I found it very exciting, but what I didn't like is that there were so many cooks involved in every screenplay, and I really liked the idea of a book. You write a book, and no matter what happens to it or who reads it, it's always exactly the same up in your head as you originally created it. So that really attracted me to it, and I love to read, and so I thought, well, you know, I'll give it a try. And once I started, I realized this is what I love.
So, David, is the book out on audio?
It is out on audio, yes.
All right, so when you're listening to the audio, you have, as an author, in your head, the voices of the people here. How difficult or, you know, how different is it for you to hear the person doing the book?
Right. Well, the book was read by Susan Burdish, who did a terrific job, including the accents. And so she did a wonderful job. I, in fact, listened to the entire book on tape while I was, you know, on the disc, rather, while I was driving. And I didn't have any trouble with it at all. It just moved so smoothly that I enjoyed it as much as I did actually reading it in print.
So what was the favorite scene in this book, City of Women, for you to write?
Oh, that's a tough one. I don't know if I can answer, say that there was a favorite scene, because when I read through it, they're all my favorite scenes. So I hate to duck it, but probably one of the most exciting scenes or important scenes for me was that first scene in the cinema when the character of Erica appears, the young woman who's doing her duty year and who first brings Sigrid into this secret life of rescuing people. And then later on with Siegfried's lover, Aegon, at the very end of the book. And I don't want to say anything more to give away the ending, but that was probably one of the big scenes for me, too.
You know, one of the scenes that I remember a couple that I really enjoy, and that's when they're in the basement and the bombs are falling around them, and they can just feel, and you can actually feel the vibrations, the way that you bring that to life.
Right.
And then you have the mother-in-law next door at a house that the lady committed suicide, and the government has opened that up for auction, I guess. And she comes out with an old-timey radio.
Right.
And you can actually see her taking this thing in to her house.
Right.
And then you can actually hear it, and you know how they... You can actually hear her tuning that to some fantastic music.
That's right. You know, she does, her friend who had been her friend and not her friend, as we find out, you know, these ancient grievances between them that came out, had committed suicide after she had publicly insulted the Nazis. And the SS came in and basically offered, auctioned off all her possessions. And here's the mother-in-law coming in with her radio. And she sets it down and listens to all the music of the time. And I tried to be as authentic and detailed about that. One of the interesting things about that radio is when the air raid was coming, a specific broadcast would come across. You'd hear the staccato rhythm, which signaled that the bombers were coming, and then the voice would come over and tell you where they were coming. They were coming from Gustav Herbert GH quarters, or sectors rather, and then in fact they were on their way to Berlin. And so that was all real, and those are the sort of the details I looked to infuse into the action.
David, if I want more information about City of Women, I know that you've got a new book coming out here. Mm-hmm. You're in the process of writing it. I'm sure you've got a website where I can visit.
I do. That's davidrgillum.com, and that's David R. Gillum, G-I-L-L-H, as in Howard, A-M, as in mother, .com. And you can also get onto my Facebook page from there.
So what do I see on there besides going to Facebook?
You'll see information about the book. You'll see reviews and of the book as well. You'll see how to subscribe to the mailing list. You'll see a small bio of me and other things that are coming. I want to do something for book clubs as well there with questions for that book clubs can use, and that sort of thing. So it's I'm building it, but the basics are there right now.
All right, well, check that out. The book is City of Women. I tell you what, there's so many good scenes in here, and you do bring it to life so well. The theater, I mean, an old-timey theater, and here's a guy and a lady. She meets a guy there, and she's married, you know. Affairs have been happening throughout the beginning of time, and you bring it to life so well in City of Women. And hey, don't be afraid. The bombs aren't really falling. David, thanks a lot.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
You've been listening to Cover to Cover. I've been your host, Mark DeWitt, along with David R. Gillum, author of A City of Women. To access this or other audio programming, visit our website, theflypod.com.